Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Dobry večer and welcome to the Bohemican Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Coleman.
And I'm Travis Dow from the History of Alchemy podcast.
Tonight we're going to talk about the significant and valued contribution made by the Jewish community to Prague and to the Czech Republic and culture as a whole here in Bohemia. We will discuss their far-reaching efforts to hold on to their faith and what stands today as their own legacy. Jewish Prague has a great deal of history to discover for pilgrims and tourists of all kinds. Prague is a favorite destination for Jewish travelers as well as tour groups that stroll along the old Jewish quarter here. Virtually untouched by time and war, the Jewish quarter still stands and still holds secrets and many traditions. I have visited areas of Jewish Prague, including the synagogues of the Old New Synagogue, the Spanish Synagogue, Pincus as well. There are so many great places to see here. I really would recommend that people get a chance to take a look at them. It's awe-inspiring to see that there's a long tradition of the Jewish people here, and it's pretty well documented, Travis. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Some of the first mentions we have of them is Jews coming through town doing business in the 9th and 10th centuries, generally coming in caravans. Now, remember that Prague is kind of a crossroads of trade networks and everything. And they were selling things like spices and silks to the wealthy, also exporting slaves from the Slavic East, weapons, beeswax, and leather to the Orient, Mediterranean, trading with the Franks, Bohemia, Greater Moravia. When they did eventually, some of them started to settle. The first little Jewish neighborhood was called Vicus Visegradensis, which is kind of a Latin way of saying Visegrad. It's the other castle in Prague. So there's the Prague Castle and Visegrad, which is back from the 7th century at least.
And that's actually, if you were coming up the Vltava River heading north towards towards Prague and Prague Castle, it would be the first thing you see on the right-hand side heading north on the river. And it's a very prominent rock. And legend holds it that the Princess Libesche actually set her baths and her castle there that overlooked the river of Vltava before things were moved a little bit further towards the left bank and Prague Castle. So that kind of gives you an idea where the first Jewish quarter was.
Mm-hmm. The first Jews were Tosafists. That doesn't mean a whole lot to me, but in case our listeners are interested, there you have it. Before 1096, they basically had the same rights as incoming Germans and French. Now, at this time, Christianity was pretty new to the region, maybe a century or less than 2 centuries old. And so it is interesting to note that they were just immigrants like Germans or French. But in 1096, a marauding crusader army, maybe 20,000 strong, were on the hunt for infidels, burning, plundering, forcing baptism as they went, and murdering those who refused. Before the 1142 Moravian invasion, they lived sort of spread out everywhere, like near the castle on the left bank, near which is where the markets were, Visegrad, like I mentioned, and there was a small settlement where Josefov is now, which is the Jewish quarter. But after the invasion, they thought it best to kind of clear the main parts of town, which were the markets and everything, and Josefov is really low, right next to the river, which is the place that flooded the most. So they kind of settled there, mostly to be left alone at the time. Now, of course, it's downtown Prague, beautiful Pajiska Street and everything.
Right,
but
right. Well, not to get ahead of us, Travis, Josefov was actually named after Joseph I, who was very friendly towards the Jewish people to basically allow them to come back after Maria Theresa had sent them packing. So that's something we'll get to a little bit later on in the show, but the name has changed several times.
And the oldest part of that town is on the corner of Kozy and Vezenska. And it's also interesting to note the very first Jews coming to Prague could have been Byzantine Jews, so not the later kind of Ashkenazi, like from Germany. However, eventually German Jews built the old New School, which before that they built a really one of the first synagogues was the Old School, right? But the old New School, which is on Shiroka, and which at that time in Germany called the Breite Gasse, which means like wide alleyway. So that's one of the oldest synagogues in Bohemia. It's Gothic style during Ottokar II. So under Ottokar II, he enforced a law which is known as the Statuta Juerum, which I think is how you pronounce it, in 1262. What was that exactly?
Well, in 1262, this gave the Jews the right to lend money, pawn, and get money back with interest, the ability to carry out their debt without paying fees, which was something that everybody else had to do at the time when their loved ones had passed away. It also gave rights to the synagogues to have their own courts. And if a Christian, and this is really important, if a Christian harmed a Jew, he would have to pay a fine to the king. And if he couldn't afford it, he would lose a hand. So, you know, that give you an idea, this was a protection. These new laws were protection for the people, including one of the most important protections was defense against blood libel. Now, Travis, what is blood libel?
Yeah, so people used to believe some pretty strange things. But medieval Christians had a very strange view of Jews, and we'll get into that a little bit later. But one thing that they thought, which I don't know where this belief came from, but they believed that Jews would actually sacrifice children and, you know, and sometimes even some kind of weird demonic rituals and who knows what else. So basically, anytime a child went missing, for whatever reason, the first place the angry mob went with pitchforks and torches and whatnot was the Jewish quarter.
One of those horrific sort of stereotypes was the fact that Gentile children's blood was used in making of matzah and food.
For instance,
exactly. So again, ridiculous stuff, but just enough to kind of get a crowd worked up into a frenzy. And I think that the king knew this, and he said, "We got to put a stop to this."
Well, there is still a fountain in Basel today. It's a UNESCO site, and it's on the fountain. It's this really squat, almost like dwarvish, elvish looking guy, but he clearly has the red pointy hat that Jews were made to wear at that time in Basel, and he's just gulping down children. He has a huge mouth, and he's got a sack full of babies, and he's just scarfing them down.
Now, how is that allowed to stay up?
It's UNESCO. It's old.
Not anti-Semitic.
I don't remember the date, but I think it's like 13th, 14th century. So it's about this time.
Yeah.
And it's just ancient. So they call it the child eater, and they just leave any Jewish reference out of it when they speak about it, but it's pretty clear.
It sounds clearly that it has a connection. Well, I kind of don't want to give too much of a grandiose sort of viewpoint to the king at the time, and we talk about Ottokar II, because he really knew where his bread was buttered, because he got the taxes like other subsequent kings in Bohemia and in Prague. He was able to rake in these taxes and these monies levied by the Jewish community, and it would be really a cash cow for the kingdom, because the money would keep coming in. He didn't want that money to be stopped, and if he had all these problems with people having issues with the Jews of the time, then the money would stop. So he had to put some level of protection. I definitely want to mention that. I don't think a lot of it had to do with some idea of feeling bad for the Jewish population or trying to protect them other than the money coming in. Wherever there are rules, there are rule breakers. And Christians found a way to circumvent some of these religious usury laws and started trying to trade more with people from abroad, and try to find other people to do their tailoring and leather work and glaziers and goldsmithing. So the Jews still felt the pinch in a lot of ways. The Jews at the time had a place in society that was hard to describe to modern ears. On one side, they were viewed to be permanent servants for their crimes against Christ and the crucifixion. On the other side, there was more of an Augustinian sort of idea that Jews were witness to the truth of Christ and therefore necessary and important, the Christ story in the Bible.
They were there.
They were there. And, remember, Jesus was Jewish. So there's that connection as well. So you had these two different camps. They were both taxed more severely during this time and considered to be personal property of the Holy Roman Emperor.
Yeah. Now, when you mentioned that, well, for one thing, it's significant. Like at one point, it was up to a fifth of the tax's income. There's another interesting quirk here. So there were, I think you mentioned that they were basically the personal property, personal servants of the emperor. I mean, the tax went directly to him. They didn't go through some roundabout way. And what this meant was that it got so quirky and weird that when a pogrom swept through the town, a pogrom is, for those that don't know, it's just anti-Semitic. It's a mob gets together and slaughters Jews. And when that happened, the king would get the property. Okay, so this got so regular. Now, why did this get regular? So the blood libel we mentioned, but another one was like the Black Plague. People had a lot of superstitions against cats. So plague was carried by rats, but Jews didn't have those superstitions, so they had cats. So when the plague swept through town, sometimes it wouldn't hit the Jewish quarters hard.
Because the cats were eating the rats.
Because the cats were eating the rats. That's all the proof they needed that the Jews had some secret deal with the devil, if it wasn't their fault, to begin with. So, right away, pitchforks and torches come out, and off to the Jewish quarter they would march. So, the king would get that property. Now, this got so regular that the king would give away houses before a pogrom would hit. He could sense the stirring. Oh, maybe a plagues coming through town, maybe a child went missing. In any case, they would just, the king would give away a house with, in the contract it would say, it is yours in case the Jews were to die or leave. So it's like, here you have a deed of the property. The guy is still alive. The Jew inhabiting the place is still there with his family, but it already belongs to the next nobleman. Like, you're just counting on the guy.
To me, that seems like that's going to set up some serious problems of why not knock off one of these guys in the Jewish community and, see if you can get his property faster since it's not going to his next of kin. Mm-hmm. So it just seems like you're putting a bullseye in the back of some of these guys in the Jewish quarter. It doesn't seem like a smart move. But, again, very tense time here. And this led up to one of the horrific massacres in 1389 during Vaclav IV's reign. This massacre starts off with a priest that was supposedly carrying the host to a dying man and was stopped and abused by supposedly the Jewish folks. And they started to throw stones at the priest. Maybe it was a small stone that was thrown at the priest. Who knows at this time?
Maybe
or if
nothing.
At all.
Yeah.
Even if at all at this point. This set off a chain reaction of priests throughout Prague calling for revenge, which is not really a Christian thing to do, by the way. So armed mobs formed and were starting to march through the streets. Jews were slaughtered with swords, and their wooden houses were set afire and burned, basically razed to the ground. If any Jew was found out in the street, they were actually pushed into these burning infernos. It was a horrific sight. Very few women and children were spared, but the ones that were forced baptized right there on the spot. All property was brought to the king. And what really was the insult to this whole thing was that no punishment was brought to the killers whatsoever. Mm-hmm. In total, 3,000, they say, were buried from this. We don't really know if the number was much higher, of course, than ones that were burned beyond recognition. But 3,000 were buried. That wasn't the end, unfortunately. Because many of the Gentiles in the area knew that the Jewish people, many of them, had pilfered away some of their money and some of their treasures and buried them in certain places. They not only went to some of the burned-out houses looking for these quote-unquote treasures, but also started going through these graves and became grave robbers. So just an absolutely horrific.
They actually had to seal off the whole quarter. It got so bad.
Just a bad, bad situation. So we can give you an idea that these pogroms were just devastating. You didn't want to be around Prague if you were a Jewish person.
Another thing we didn't really get into, but this forced baptism, that might not seem so bad to someone, but you have to understand that, and it depends on the community here. So, different times in different communities, but some rabbis would say that a forced baptism was very much like a rape victim. And even if the person wanted to remain Jewish and wanted to be Jewish, he said, no, I'm sorry, that's it. You're now baptized. You're no longer one of us. And they just would not accept her, you know, even if it was against her will. So, and again, this depends. This was you know, one rabbi in particular's view. But so sometimes that was, you know, you survived some horrible ordeal and you were still shunned. So, I mean, it was, you were just unclean from then on.
Again, Prague's history is at times the worst of Europe had to offer, and also the best of what Europe has to offer.
To be fair, you know, this wasn't just Prague. This was all over. But
right,
yeah,
right. I think the history of Prague and throughout Bohemia, you're going to have these horrible, horrible stories, and you're also going to have on the flip side of it some amazing discoveries of scientific discoveries. You're going to have art, well, freedom. You're going to have freedoms of people, and we will get to that part. There were times where Prague was actually the freest place to be if you were Jewish,
yeah,
in all of Central Europe.
Well, here's
just not now.
One flip side, yeah, not yeah.
Not at this point in the 14th century.
In the Hussite Wars, which was in the early 15th century, the Jews were often left alone. So they, you know, the reformers, the Protestants had bigger fish to fry, except.
Well, and if I can interject real quickly here,
you there were
opportunities, there were situations where some of the leading members of the Jewish community would attend some of these Protestant churches during their services, mainly because that the Protestants, they felt, had a closer connection to the old scripture.
Yeah.
Of the Old Testament than their Catholic counterparts.
Yeah, well,
which I find that very interesting in my research for the show they were very strange bedfellows.
Yeah, yeah. No, the Protestants would often just re-examine the scriptures, and I mean that's part of what the Reformation was. So then they would re-examine these weird superstitions like blood libel and things, and realize there's no scriptural basis. But, however, in Chomutov, during the Hussite Wars, a lot of Jews actually chose death over forced baptism. And in Vienna, who were Catholics, the Jews were all slaughtered because they were being accused of selling weapons to the Hussites, because the Hussites were tended to be more pro-Jewish. So again, the reformers, you know, questioned the Jews' place again and re-examined it. But some thought that the Antichrist would have to be a Jew, okay? But others said that Antichrist, to be pure evil, it would have to come from evil Christians themselves. Jan Hus, in fact, had this view that, you know, so Jan Hus did not think the Antichrist would be Jewish. In fact, but he also had some strange views that he said that before the end of time, that Jews would see the light and of their own free will convert to Christianity, have this that okay.
Well, there's always
we'll
gonna
leave
be
them alone, but they're going to see the light, eventually,
right? And
you know,
there are always going to be some sort of divisions. I think to say that humanity with the religious tolerances have come a long way, even though we still have a long way to go. That to live in this era would have been very difficult. If you were Protestant, if you were Catholic, depending on the year, or mostly throughout history, if you were Jewish,
yeah,
it would have been very difficult. But that leads us to something that we call the Golden Age. Now, mm-hmm. is it really that golden? Because at certain points, I'm thinking, well, maybe it's just not so bad for the Jewish population. But it didn't start off probably as great as you would think with that title, the Golden Age. Because at the time when the Turks were marching their way through Europe and they were besieging Vienna, a lot of people accused Jews for spying for the Turks.
Yep.
And as a matter of fact, there was a fire in 1541 that damaged Hrachny and the Castle Hill here, destroying the archives. And under torture, a Jew confessed, and the pogroms ensued once again.
And we mentioned this in a different podcast about Rudolf II. They were allowed to come back in 1567. So this it didn't last so long. And we mentioned this in Rudolf II's podcast. This was his father and had some laws to kind of protect them. And we mentioned that...
And this would be Maximilian II.
Right, Maximilian II.
Right.
So, for instance, protection against the Christian guilds, because, you know, they had kind of monopolies in certain businesses. So, you know, they would have the right to do business and make money. And in fact, this got so good that the largest community in the diaspora was in Prague. A very famous Jew of this time was Mordecai Meisel. And this is Rudolf's... I think this whole idea is kind of funny. Like when I was doing the research, I was reading something in German and I came across that Mordecai was Rudolf's Hofjude, which means the court Jew. So I can just see him lining him up, because Rudolph, you know, we love this guy. Me and Pete, we, you know, he's a great character. And because, you know, he had this whole mystical Prague thing. I really do recommend that episode on him. But so, you know, you can just see him lining up his court and introducing him to someone, saying, yeah, this is, you know, Tycho Brahe, my court astrologer, and this is Michael Sedzivoy, my court alchemist. And here we have Mordecai Meisel, my court Jew.
It sounds a little off to my ears.
It's strange.
I know.
Maybe he didn't say it like that, but that's, you know, that was like in quotes, like he's the Hofjude, he's the court Jew. One of the rites that he did, that Rudolph did, was he would give interest free of loans to poor Jews. He built the still standing Jewish town hall and much more. He provided funds for Rudolph's war against the Turks. So Mordecai was fairly wealthy and actually supported the war against the Turks. There is some truth to the fact that Jews may have been more pro-Muslim than pro-Christian, because the Muslims all over treated them much better than the Christians.
Well, and this does have some truth, especially in the Holy Land.
I wouldn't say they were spies. I mean, the evidence can obviously get way out of hand.
Right, if you look at when some of the Crusades ended and were pushed, people were pushed back into Europe. If you wanted to visit the Holy Land, you could do it. You were allowed to go down there and do that. However, if you wanted to live down there, you paid a tax.
Yeah.
If you weren't Muslim, so there was probably some freedom to practice your religion, but you paid for it.
I would say, but greater safety. Like another example. So even this you know, most honored Mordecai Meisel, Rudolph promised to honor Meisel's last will and testament. Okay, which was very rare at the time. Like we said, when a Jew passes away, the property goes straight to the emperor or the king. But Rudolph promised to honor his will, his last will. However, a few days after his death, Rudolph had his house searched and everything confiscated to the crown. Okay, so not that great. But there were others. Rabbi Lowe, he's really famous for the Gollum story, so you might have known him from there. And we'll get into that a little bit later. Now, here's the interesting part, is that he's an ancestor of Louis Brandeis, a U.S. Supreme Court justice, and after whom Brandeis University was named.
I did not know that.
There you go.
Interesting.
Basically, his reforms were to go back to orthodoxy. So Jews at this point were becoming very secular. I mean, you have to remember they're a minority everywhere. So they were just trying to blend in and kind of, you know, taking religion a little bit more lightly and their laws from the Talmud and whatnot. And Rabbi Lowe kind of took a firmer stance and said, do not touch Gentile wine, don't accept money from Gentiles for ritual services.
He pushed the reset button.
Yeah. Well, yeah. This happened many, many times. But, you know, he was one of those. He was maybe the most well-known at the time and even later for kind of, you know, being firm on you know, holding a stance. He went so far, he said, he considered the Jews formed and the Gentile not quite formed matter. He wanted to go back to the source matter, the Torah, for studies, which, again, a lot of people, there was many writings and many books you could study, and he wanted the Torah to be above the rest, as it probably should be. An interesting thing about Rabbi Lowe, he's obviously falsely claimed to be a Kabbalist. Now, this is almost definitely not true. In fact, when we talk about Kabbalism, this was mostly a Spanish movement. There was probably some of that going on in Venice. But Prague, there's very little mention of Kabbalah in Prague. I'm not going to say it didn't happen. There's no references. There's no sources for it. The reason for these stories and the strong connection is that he lived during the time of mystical Prague. Again, if you talk about Rudolf II, it's full of alchemists, magic, astrology, all these things. So Kabbalah fits right in there, but not with Rabbi Lowe. Along these mystical lines, now, this should be noted that Rabbi Lowe was not a Kabbalist, but again, this story has become so famous that you can't really separate Prague and Judaism without recanting this story, which is, of course, the Gollum.
If you come to Prague, you'll see shop after shop with this clay man figure that's maybe got two eyes and a mouth.
I have one.
You have one? Yeah, everyone's got one. A t-shirt, a bumper sticker, a figurine of the Gollum. Very famous name. As a matter of fact, our listeners back home in the United States might know some residual effects of this. I know at one point, Time Magazine had an article said Superman and his inner Jew, right? Mm-hmm. Well, why is that? Well, because the two authors of the Superman that name actually were a Jewish Canadian and a Jewish American that put this thing together in the 1930s. And the idea was that it had to be a protector of the Jewish people as this fascism of Nazism, fascism was coming up up into realms in Europe in the 1930s. There had to be a protector of the Jewish people. That was Superman, which was a byproduct of the Golem, which was a very focused Bohemian tradition from Rabbi Lowe. So if we take a look at Rabbi Lowe, yeah, we don't want to necessarily say that he was a Kabbalist. However, there are some people that say that he had some Kabbalist leanings. Again, Travis says not so fast, but this story does have some mysticism involved with it as well. So Rabbi Lowe was known as the Exalted One. He was beloved by the people here in Prague. Especially the Jewish community. He was a man of letters. He was a man of intelligence. He had the ear of Emperor Rudolf II. So he really was established. So having this myth attached to him really isn't that far of a stretch. This myth is unusual in the fact that it's supposed to have happened in a very specific year, the year 1580. There was a new danger brewing in Prague, and it had to deal with a notorious priest that was planning to accuse the Jews of a blood libel once again. So Rabbi Lowe heard about this, and to avert this horrible danger, directed his dream question to heaven to help him save his people. And that comes back a little bit to a very interesting Psalm 139:16. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. Now, this is a good precursor to what this dream was all about. He was going to make a clay man. Now, this clay man, keep in mind about creating life other than the birds and the bees version that we all know of. You don't create life. That's God's mission, to create life, not man. And to do so would be basically forbidden in most religious circles, including Judaism. It can be justified if this would be saving lives. And therefore, Rabbi Lowe was instructed to try this horrifying task. He was going to create this golem with divine help using Kabbalistic formulas communicated to him in his dreams. Now, again, here's that word Kabbalistic. If Kabbalah was part of this or not, Travis, you say no?
In the story, yes.
In the story, yes. But yeah. Historical Rabbi Lowe probably would have said nah.
This is totally Kabbalah. Yeah.
Right, okay.
But the myth predates it by a good couple hundred years.
It's just somehow attached to Rabbi Lowe because of his fame.
It just fits so well.
Okay,
yeah.
So keep that in mind as we're reading the story, folks. So yeah. Rabbi Lowe had to use the word Shem HaMaforash, which means the true name of God, the true word of God. And which is also known to just a few holy men of each generation. And we can say that because we're not actually saying that, the specific word for God. But it was very dangerous to pronounce, as you can tell that I'm having a hard time with it. But the power that it unleashed could turn against a man who uttered it. So he received his answer in an order that is alphabetical in Hebrew, which means, make a golem of clay, and you will destroy the entire Jew-baiting company. This was the only part of the message that was really heard, and the inner meaning had to be understood to be very, very effective. Rabbi Lowe extracted the real message by a special Kabbalistic formula. He needed two assistants for this, a Kohen and a Levite, a Jew descended from the tribe of Levi, and who was of the priestly class and the temple eras. He also called his son-in-law a Kohen, a Jew descended from the ancient order of priests, and his pupil a Levite. He explained that they needed four elements, fire, water, air, and earth. After a day of purification, they went to the river Vltava. By torchlight, they sculpted a giant body out of a river clay. The golem lay before them, facing heaven. The Kohen walked seven times around the body from right to left, reciting the special prayer. The clay turned bright red, much like fire. Then the Levite walked another seven times around the body, the other way, reciting another prayer. The fire-like redness disappeared, and the water flowed through the body. He grew hair and nails, which, Travis, is a little bit different from the form that we see that's put on every T-shirt here.
Yeah, I don't remember him having hair and nails, because that's gross.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
That's nasty.
It seemed a little too human-like, but I guess that's how the tradition goes here. Then Rabbi Lowe walked once around the body and placed a piece of parchment in his mouth, on which was written Shem HaMaforash, the Word of God. He bowed to the east, west, south, and north, and all three of them recited together, "And he breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul." With this utterance, the golem opened his eyes and looked at his creator. They dressed him and took him to the synagogue where he could get ready to start his mission. Eventually, the golem was no longer necessary after protecting the Jewish people, and some people say the golem actually went mad and became a danger to the entire Jewish community. So therefore, Rabbi Lowe decided to return him to the void from which he came. He did this by reciting the Shem HaForash, and with it, the life principle, and thus restored the golem into lifeless clay. The clay figure had to be hidden in the attic of a synagogue, and no one was permitted to enter it again until many, many years later. Some writers during the 19th century claimed that the outlines of this giant body could still be seen there in this attic. Now, Travis, you mentioned before this podcast today, when we were talking about the research for the show, that there was one particular German that didn't pay heed to this sort of hands-off sort of idea about the golem.
Yeah, no, there's a couple interesting things to note here, which, first of all, this is a great story, but it actually, the first mentions of this were as early as the 12th century. So way before Rabbi Lowe. But I think this was kind of a famous version that someone wrote up much later and then attributed to him. Well, you mentioned another, in the Rudolf II podcast, you mentioned another famous story about Rabbi Lowe, where Rabbi Lowe actually meets the emperor.
I love this story. That's a great story. If you can't listen to that, but if you can imagine that Rabbi Lowe had such prominence at this time that he invited the emperor, Rudolf II, to his house for dinner. And when the emperor entered this home of this venerated rabbi, he was awestruck about the opulence that this supposedly poor Jewish rabbi had in his beautiful residence and the great food that was offered to him. He basically really became enamored with Rabbi Lowe.
Yeah.
And from that point on, the Rabbi Lowe had the emperor's ear.
Mm-hmm. So this is your cue to listen to that other episode.
Absolutely, you need to listen to it. It's fantastic.
There's another person of note at that time during Rudolf II's court was Joseph Solomon del Medigo. He was born on Crete to a rabbinic family. I like this guy because he went to university in Padua at the same time where Galileo was there, and Galileo actually allowed him to look through his telescope with him, something that he denied even Kepler.
Oh, that would have been amazing to be able to rub elbows with Galileo Galilei at University of Padua, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, okay. Kepler had some correspondence with Galileo, but look through his telescope, he did not.
Nah.
Yeah, in fact, this Del Medigo eventually settled in Prague, and after many travels, many, many travels, was buried there in 1655. Speaking of buried, this cemetery is world famous, one of the most famous Jewish cemeteries. And in fact, you can walk right by it and not even see it because it's 9 feet up. The Jewish quarter, they gave them a certain parcel of land to bury their dead and no more for centuries. So when they ran out of room, which is not a huge cemetery.
It's relatively pretty small.
Yeah. And so they started stacking the coffins, stacking the bodies, and stacking the headstones. So the cemetery is like up on the second floor, really. I mean, you can walk right by the wall, not even know that you're eye level with a bunch of corpses on the other side. And just the fact that the headstones are so stacked is also, I would bet you've seen a picture of it and haven't known. Probably you'll put a picture up on bohemian.com.
It actually is up right now of the cemetery, and there's also a biography on Rabbi Lowe that is buried in the cemetery. The walkways are relatively very skinny, and it's a little bit of a trial to get through some of these areas, but you can pick up a map when you get admission to get into this area of the Jewish quarter, and it will help you kind of know where things are. But I remember actually being in the Jewish cemetery, taking my son there as well, and I saw some Orthodox Jews praying in front of Rabbi Lowe's tombstone, uh-huh, which is there. Yeah. And it really kind of brought it together for me to say, wow, people are making pilgrimages here. And I started thinking of the places that I've traveled in Europe that had significant footholds of Jewish history. And one place came to mind as the antithesis of what is left in Prague, which would be Warsaw. There's nothing left there.
Yeah.
I went to see the Jewish quarter, and there is a little bit of a train station, some barbed wire that is left as a monument and a grassy area for a park.
And
that's it.
And that is not by accident.
No, all by design. And to see that what's left here in Prague, even as small as it is, several blocks in a circle area near the Vltava River. It's just not much, but it's significant.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hope that if you do come to Prague, spend some time down there.
No, it's great.
It is amazing, full of history, and something that I think you really need to take in part. You know, there's so much to talk about when we talk about Jewish history and, unfortunately, the Holocaust in the 20th century. We can't fit it on this particular podcast. It's for another podcast. But we will kind of give you a little snippet of what we know. And some of the stories are hard to deal with, but something that definitely needs to talk about from the extermination in Terezin,
mm-hmm.
That's further afield, heading towards the north of Bohemia from here in Prague. I've been there, and that is a hard experience to see. But that's something I think everybody needs to take a trip on to really put that in perspective. A little closer to home here in Prague, where we're doing our podcast tonight, there is something very unique, a statue that many people don't see or really understand, that's at the train station.
The main train station, right, on the first platform. And if you've ever been to Prague, and especially by train, you may have seen this and not known what it was. Because it's just it's a life-sized person holding a small kind of toddler in his arms and a young girl next to him. And then he has a suitcase next to him. And but you can tell that the clothing, the suitcase, are a little old-fashioned, like, you know, maybe 1940s, let's say, and 1930s. And that is of Nicholas Winton.
Sir Nicholas Winton saw where the winds of war were blowing in the 1930s and knew that the Jewish people were in trouble. So what he did was after his normal job, he would go home and start really working. And he would try to line up English families that would take Jewish children that he would try to smuggle basically out of Czechoslovakia. And at the time, he had this network where he would gather Jewish families that would agree to this, putting their children onto these trains with just a suitcase or two, and head them north toward the French border, and then off to England to have their children stay in freedom. So again, this is probably another episode that we can do in the future on Sir Nicholas Winton, but his amazing efforts saved thousands of young Jewish children that would have most likely gone to concentration camps and not been able to hear from again. So that statue, you would think it would be some kindly dedicek, as we would say in the Czech Republic in the Czech language, some kindly grandfather image of holding a child saying goodbye on the train. But what that was his efforts to try to get as many Jewish children out as possible. So there are legacies like that all around Prague. You just have to look for them.
Part of town where I live in, right in the center, there's these – it's basically all the sidewalks are cobblestone, and it's all the – you know, even a lot of the streets where I live are cobblestone. But where a Jew used to live before they were deported during the Holocaust, there's a slightly bigger than normal – cobblestone made of brass, and it says their name on it, and when they died, and or when they were born and they died. And that kind of, it gives a story in and of itself, because right next door to where I live, there's two brass cobblestones, you know, a Mr. and a Mrs. of some name, and sometimes you see three or four if it was a whole family, or you know, you just see one that says, you know, family so-and-so. And so you instantly get a sense that, man, something horrible happened here, and that, you know, on the street that I live on, like, my neighbors were deported.
Well, that's our program for tonight. What we want to do is have you contact us through bohemican.com, through the contact tab, and tell us what you thought about the show tonight. If you are of Jewish faith and there's something that we missed, or I know there's probably some things we mispronounced, but if there's something that we could do to make a note on the next podcast, we would more than be happy to do that. Don't want to leave anything out, but it's a very long history here. So please feel free to go to the contact page on bohemican.com and let us know what you thought about the show. So our bibliography tonight is Prague in Black and Gold by Peter Dimitz, Dr. Ilya Arbel, PhD on the Golem Information, that we got that from the web, as well as the Exhibition Guide to Jewish Customs and Traditions by Alexander Putnik, Eva Koskova, and Dana Kabanova. So tonight, we want to thank you all for listening. We appreciate your time with us, either at home or on the way to work. We appreciate you listening to the Bohemican Podcast. Remember, please go to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. We really could use your help with that. And remember to rate us on that as well. Give us the stars you think we deserve.
Yep, you really help us out by doing that. Get up the ratings there. Also, come check out our sister podcast, History of Alchemy podcast at historyofalchemy.com. See you again in 2 weeks. Thank you very much.
Ciao for now.